Well, Judge, thank you for that very nice introduction. I was thinking as he was talking about the fact that I happen to be the majority whip and my role in the elected leadership in the Senate, that it's true that I'm the number two person in leadership in my household as well. I'm just one step ahead of the cat, if the truth be told. But it is good to be back with all of you. Thank you for hosting Sandy and I. And, of course, it's always good to see you up in Washington, D.C. when we're up. As Phil Graham liked to say, we feel like we're doing the Lord's work in the devil's city. And it's good to see friendly faces and folks from back home. But it is, Judge, good to be here on a day of particular significance to all of us, and that is our veterans. And I see some of our folks in uniform in the back of the room. Thank you for your service. But and I just had the chance to be out at Texas A&M to with Eric Fanning, the Secretary of the Army, meeting with some of our students who are veterans themselves and talking about what we can do to better facilitate and encourage the transition from active duty military service to college life and to leadership roles in our communities, in our state, and our nation. But I like to think that Texas A&M has a particular affinity for men and women in uniform and is the best place for training our future military leaders. With all due respect to our service academy grads, and I get the privilege of nominating people for our service academies that do a fantastic job, I always think about what General Patton said. He said, "Give me an army of West Point graduates and I'll win a battle. Give me a handful of Texas Aggies and I'll win a war." So I'm glad to spend some time with you in this community that's focused on educating and preparing our next generation of leaders. The second reason I'm here to be here today is to help honor Royce Hickman. Royce, as you know, is getting ready to step down from full-time leadership. I have no doubt that he will continue to dabble and support the chamber in every way he can. But Royce, you've spent a lot of time working on behalf of this community and the business leadership, and you've done a lot to help support not only this community but our states and our state's economy. Thank you for your service. And if Mary can stand you at home for a little bit more of the day, God bless her. Well, I know what you're thinking. We've just been through a pretty unbelievable election. And I think all of us are trying to figure out what exactly happened. You know, for myself, I actually find it very encouraging that when people don't like the direction our country is going in, that they show up at the ballot box and they vote to change it. And so no matter who you voted for or against in the election, whether it's local, state, or federal, I hope we continue to live in a country where the government, we don't work for the government, but the government works for us. And it's pretty clear that the voters spoke up loud and clear. I will say we're still trying to figure out exactly what they were saying. But I have a few ideas of my own. If you look at the right track, wrong track of the country, two-thirds of the voters think that the country's on the wrong track. And you might ask, why is that? Well, after we were told that Obamacare would be a panacea, which would fully cover everybody and would cost a family of four $2,500 less, where you'd be able to keep your own doctor and you'd be able to keep your own policy, and none of that ended up being true, well, it's not surprising that people rose up and reacted the way they do, the way they did. And then there's our economy. Now, we're a little bit insulated here in Texas, even though a significant part of our economy is from oil and gas. We've been growing relative to the rest of the country, and you have to wonder why it is that the world's greatest economy after the slowdown and actually the Great Recession of 2008 didn't bounce back as it has historically over the years. Senator Phil Graham, who I know taught at Texas A&M, an economist, PhD economist, has pointed out numerous times that after a recession like that, usually you have what they call a V-shaped recovery. But we haven't seen that. It's remained flat or U-shaped at best. And then it's our foreign policy, where America has receded from its leadership role in the world only to find that vacuum filled by some pretty dangerous people that's put not only our country at risk, but other people around the world. And then we've seen a judiciary that doesn't believe it's their job simply to enforce the laws that are passed by Congress or the Constitution as written, but rather they believe that their role is to make policies and substitute their judgment for that of the American people and their elected representatives. And then we've seen an economy, too, strangled by overregulation, not just banks, but virtually any sector of the economy you talk about, whether it's executive orders or regulations issued by executive branch agencies that have run amok. But as before we talk about what this election has wrought in terms of the changes and what the opportunities I believe that this election has presented, let's go back a little bit and look at what we've been able to do in the last 2 years. Now, I know it's not, you probably have not been, it hadn't penetrated because of the amped up rhetoric of both the Republican primary for Congress as well as just sort of the polarization in our country. You probably haven't heard very much about some of these things that we've been able to do with new leadership in the Congress, even with a president with whom we don't often agree. But first of all, one of the things that I thought was very important for us to do is to pass a transportation bill. You know, coming from a big, fast-growing state like ours, I don't have to tell you that congestion is an issue, but also the free flow of commerce and also concern about our environment. And previously, we had been fallen into the bad habit of not passing long-term transportation bills. The one we passed is for 5 years. And the simple benefit of doing that as opposed to a six-month or one-year patch is that it gives us an opportunity to plan and spend money a lot more efficiently and a lot more effectively. This has been a particular frustration of mine because, as you know, the gas tax that we pay on a gallon of gas doesn't go as far as it used to. And Texas, being a big state, only gets about 92 cents back on the dollar for every dollar we send to Washington, D.C. on the gas tax. That's what my friend, former Senator Steve Ogden, used to call money laundering by the federal government. And he's right. But that's the bargain that we struck back, the so-called grand bargain during the Constitutional Convention. The little states get two senators, too. And so the little states gang up on the big states, and we end up with less than a buck on every dollar we send to Washington. But for us to keep up with the growth in our state, where people continue to vote with their feet and come from parts of the United States and around the world where they have less opportunity to work and to provide for their family, they're coming here to Texas, and that has consequences. And for us to stay competitive, for us to, we need to be able to plan those infrastructure improvements for tomorrow and for the next year and beyond. So obviously, this is really important. The A&M Transportation Institute estimated in the year 2020, 8.4 billion hours will be lost just simply sitting in traffic, $8.4 billion. And that's not just a lot of time. That's a lot of gasoline and obviously a lot of frustration as well. So this is one of the things that we were able to do. It wasn't without significant pain because we had to find a way to pay for the bill as opposed to continuing to add to the deficit. But I do think it represents some progress, although it's modest progress, trying to provide a more predictable means to provide for our transportation infrastructure in our state and around the country. Now, you may have missed this one, too. I'm talking about K-12 education. You've heard of No Child Left Behind, but one of the problems with No Child Left Behind, despite its good intentions, was to concentrate more power over public education in Washington, D.C., and require teachers to teach to the test and then be rated based on the outcome. So one of the things that we decided we needed to do, and again, nothing happens in Washington unless it happens on a bipartisan basis, is Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee, Senator Patty Murray, got together and produced a bill called the Every Student Succeeds Act. Not only did it repeal the Common Core mandate, but it devolved more authority back to our states, back to our school districts, to parents, teachers, and local communities. President George Herbert Walker Bush, number 41, once said, "Think about every problem we face. The solution starts with education." And that's right. But in a country as big and diverse as ours, with some 320 million people, the idea that you can legislate solutions at the national level in a one-size-fits-all solution is just defies reality. And we saw that in healthcare, we saw that in education. And so what we need to do is recognize the fundamental genius of our founding fathers who believed that a federal system rather than a national system of government would work best for a country as big and diverse as ours. So I bet you'll agree with me that we don't need Washington bureaucrats telling our local school districts or our states how they ought to accomplish the goal. Those of you who are managers and leaders in your businesses and in the community recognize if you try to micromanage things, frequently the best of intentions will end up in inadequate or unintended results. And I frankly think that has happened in education and why it's so important for us to devolve or transfer more of that power from the federal government back to the states. It's also true in the higher education realm. We're going to be taking up a bill to reauthorize the so-called Higher Education Act, and we hope to see in that bill as well some of the regulatory burdens taken off the backs of our universities so that with enlightened leadership like you have here at Bryan College Station, at great national institutions like Texas A&M, they can innovate and they can do things that really, frankly, will present us set of best practices that will challenge others around the country. Later today, Sandy and I'll have a chance to visit the grand opening of the new veterinary and biomedical education complex here at Texas A&M. And of course, Texas A&M has a long history, about 100 years of veterinary education excellence. And so this is more than a new building. It represents the next stage of innovation and growth and in practice of veterinary medicine, which is so important to our agricultural economy and to our state and to our country. We also did a few other things that I'll just mention just in passing that you might find of interest that probably, again, you hadn't heard a whole lot about. I happen to be very involved as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee and as a recovering judge and attorney general in the issue of human trafficking. This is a particularly pernicious practice because it targets typically young girls between the age of 12 and 14. Frequently, they're runaways from home. They think maybe they found somebody to take care of them look after them. Maybe they think they've found a new boyfriend, only to find themselves essentially ending up as modern-day slaves, whether for sex or involuntary servitude or the like. We finally passed a bill based on the Crime Victims Compensation Fund model at the here in Austin, where the fees and penalties were paid by the people who get convicted of violations of our laws. They go into a fund that can then be used to provide grants to non-government organizations, other groups that are trying to provide healing and help for these victims of human trafficking. I think we've come a long way in this area because no longer do we consider the young girls, for example, who I mentioned earlier, to be criminals, but rather to be victims and people that we need to reach out to and help as they try to turn their life around after living through unbelievable circumstances. We've also done little things, but I think they are significant, like making sure that we are supporting our local law enforcement much more effectively. The federal government spends $2 billion of your tax dollars a year in supporting state and local law enforcement. And some of that money, frankly, I don't think is spent all that effectively. But one of the things we've done is make sure that more of it is targeted for training, particularly to deal with things like active shooter scenarios. After Columbine in Colorado, law enforcement realized they had to adjust to a new normal when it comes to threats in our communities. And rather than barricade on the outside in the context of an active shooter context, they had to train law enforcement actually to crash the site, put themselves in harm's way, and to stop the threat, as well as make sure that they worked hand in glove with our emergency medical personnel to save those who were injured. And so this is something that I'm glad we were able to do and pass something called the Police Act. We've also been active in trying to deal with this new threat of opioid and heroin abuse that's plaguing parts of our country. The prescription drug overdose problem is particularly bad in places in like West Virginia, Ohio, New Hampshire, and elsewhere. And when they can't find the opioids or prescription drugs, then frequently they'll go to a cheap substitute in heroin. But the number of people who've been affected by this opioid and heroin problem is very big, and we've tried our best to come up with some way to address it again. We tried to continue to make our government more transparent. As a conservative, I've always felt that rather than passing a new regulation, frequently one of the best things that we can do in government is to make it more transparent. Because you know what? I found that people behave differently when they know what they're doing is going to be in the public domain. And it changes behavior for the better. And I think passing legislation that has improved our Freedom of Information Act, which is the federal counterpart to our Open Records and Open Meetings Act at the state level, is a very important part of that. And strange as it may sound, I found a partner in Senator Pat Leahy from Vermont. He's my polar opposite from an ideological perspective. He's a liberal from Vermont. I'm a conservative from Texas, but we both have gotten together and joined hands and worked to improve our freedom of information laws, which I know can be challenging for our government officials and the bureaucracy to deal with, but which I think are fundamentally important to maintaining the power in the people rather than in the bureaucracy and in the government. And then, of course, we're trying to do everything we can to capitalize on this incredible renaissance in American energy. Last December, we lifted the export ban on American petroleum, which I believe was very important to make sure that there are markets available around the world for the energy that we produce here in the United States and that our prices are competitive with world markets. But you know what? This is an important part of our national security and helping our allies, too, because in parts of the world, like Europe, Putin and Russia uses energy as a weapon, because if people are dependent on a sole source of that energy, then they're going to be cowed into cooperating with thugs like Vladimir Putin. But if they can get exports from the United States, that's an important part not only of maintaining their economy, but some of their independence and relationship with us. We're working hard to do this to expedite the liquefied natural gas exports permitting process. Part of the problem is that, as you know, it's very much in vogue to talk about climate change and those sorts of issues, and I don't think a sufficient appreciation for what we have in America in terms of our natural resources. I'm an all-of-the-above kind of guy. I'm proud of the fact that we generate more electricity than any other state from renewable sources here in the United States and in Texas. But the fact of the matter is it still is a relatively small percentage of our energy needs. And the last thing we need to do is raise prices on electricity and energy for people on fixed incomes and our senior citizens. So this is an important part of developing the natural resources that we've been blessed with, taking advantage of the expertise that Texans have developed. And indeed, now we're exporting that expertise around the world as well. Well, I talk a little bit about what we have done over the last couple of years, and I know Congressman Flores' representative is here, and I have to tell you, Bill Flores has been such a great ally, and I'm really encouraged to see him aspiring to further leadership in the House of Representatives in the new Congress. He's a terrific partner. But looking forward, this election, as surprising as it was for many of us, and certainly the mainstream media are absolutely baffled by what happened. Of course, I don't think they actually talked to very many real people. They tend to focus on the elites in Washington and on the East Coast, in New York and elsewhere, and they don't actually talk to regular folks. And certainly the establishment, a political class in Washington, D.C., who believes that they know better than you do what's good for you, and you just ought to accept it. I think this has been a tremendous repudiation of that attitude, but also a great opportunity for us to take advantage of it. We need to do a better job, for example, of course, here on Veterans Day, dealing with our veterans and their needs. We recently introduced and passed legislation which would provide veterans more choices in their local communities if the waiting time was too long or if they had to go too far to get the health care they need. Some of our veterans' health care needs can be taken care of in the local communities by private practitioners, hospitals, and doctors. Conversely, some of them need to go to some of these institutions of the Veterans Administration that has developed a world-class practice and things that, frankly, most private practitioners don't see very often. But providing more choices for our veterans and making sure that we empower the managers and the leadership of the Veterans Affairs Administration, the ability to fire people who don't follow directions, is really important. And I know it's a little shocking to the private sector that if people aren't doing their job, that they can't be removed. But because of the bureaucracy, because of the unions and other relationships that have developed over time, it's very hard for the Veterans Administration to fire people who are not doing their job. And I'm optimistic that we're going to pass important legislation to do that. It's also important, as we talked this morning with Secretary of the Army Fanning, to make sure that as our veterans make the transition into the private sector, that they not only take advantage of the educational benefits that they have under the GI Bill, and particularly I'm proud of the post-9/11 GI Bill of Rights, the modern GI Bill of Rights that we passed, that make those benefits transferable to family members. So if you serve long enough in the military, you qualify not only for those benefits for yourself, but many veterans have already completed their formal education, and so they were essentially of no use to them. So what we did is make those transferable both to children and other family members. We also need to make sure that once these veterans leave their additional education, that they can find jobs in the private sector. And I've been proud to work with one of our Aggie members of Congress, Will Hurd, who I'm really happy won his election in the 23rd Congressional District, and George P. Bush, to highlight the successful efforts in places like San Antonio to hire more veterans in law enforcement, especially with those who've had experience and training in the military. Why in the world wouldn't we take advantage of that by helping them find work in the civilian sector in the law enforcement area? If there's one subject that I hear more about, there's not one subject I hear more about when it comes to the business community than overregulation. And I think, frankly, that's a manifestation of what we've seen in Washington since President Obama was elected. The first 2 years the president was in office, he had an unprecedented 60 members of his own political party in the United States Senate and majority in the House, which meant they could pretty much run the table when it came to legislation, starting with Obamacare, moving then to Dodd-Frank for the financial services sector. After the voters gave Republicans a majority in the House, then we had divided government, and it made that harder to do. And then, of course, when Republicans won the majority in the Senate, it made it even more difficult for that to happen legislatively. But what we saw happen is a proliferation of executive orders and an unprecedented in-run around the authority of Congress. And it's not just because it undermines the prerogatives of members of Congress. It's because it undermines the authority you've delegated to your elected representatives to represent you. And so one of the things that I think is going to be presented with a new administration that's sworn in January 20th is, first of all, a repeal of many of these executive orders, which can be done unilaterally by the new president without even consultation with Congress, which is his prerogative, but also an effort to begin to claw back the overregulation, which has literally strangled our economic growth. In August, we passed an unfortunate mile marker, 600 major regulations issued by this administration alone. That's far more than any of the president's predecessors, and it comes with a $700 billion price tag for our economy. So we're not talking about the wild, wild west. We're not saying repeal all regulation, but there is a point at which common sense regulation becomes over-regulation and overreach, and it has definite consequences in terms of our growth in our economy and jobs and opportunity that goes along with that. Of course, as the judge said when he introduced me, one of the things I've taken great pride in, and this didn't surprise you at all, in looking at things that have worked here in Texas and saying, you know, this is the model for what we ought to do at the national level. Actually, that's what I think Justice Louis Brandeis meant when he called the states the laboratories of democracy. Again, compared to what we've seen the last 8 years, which is doing things at the national level in a one-size-fits-all, what we're talking about is growing things from the bottom up and experimenting at the local and state level, seeing what works, and then scaling those up if they work. So I'm with Governor Perry when he said, you know, people talk about the Texas miracle. I agree with him that God has certainly blessed our great state, but a miracle is a supernatural occurrence, and what has happened in Texas is not just the result of a supernatural occurrence. It's a result of the right policies, smaller, less taxes, more reasonable regulation, and a welcoming embrace to people who are investing and creating jobs in our great state. So I believe that in the next Congress, starting in January, working with people like Bill Flores, Kevin Brady, and the rest of the Texas delegation in the House, that we're going to have a great opportunity to reel in the overregulation, to change our broken tax code, which is the most oppressive, basically, of anywhere in the world, and leaves trillions of dollars parked overseas because people don't want to be subject to double taxation, to be able to bring that money back to the United States to invest in new infrastructure and new jobs and economic growth. But one of the things that we're going to do, I predict very soon, is to repeal the president's signature health care law known as Obamacare. Again, I mentioned this earlier, but when the president was selling this new legislation, obviously the concern was too many people didn't have access to affordable health care. But my position is that this legislation didn't fix that at all. In fact, it made it more expensive. And they said, well, we'll subsidize it. We'll tax you more in order to provide subsidies so it costs a certain group of people less. Well, not everybody enjoys those subsidies. And unfortunately, this is what happens when the federal government tries to overreach and tries to micromanage one-sixth of our economy. Some people have benefited, but frankly, some of the things that we could have done, like covering young people to age 26 or dealing with things like pre-existing conditions, we could have done without this whole overhaul of our health care system. So I believe we're going to see a repeal of Obamacare, and then we'll transition into health care, which I believe will become more affordable and more accessible, and rather than have government try to micromanage it and mandate it, it'll leave it up to you and your family to make the choices that best suit your needs. So in conclusion, let me just say this has been a wild ride the last 18 months or so, but we now know that the American people have spoken, and now it's our job to step up and figure out how we can take the message that they've delivered by their vote and the new leadership that they've delivered to try to work in their best interest. But I always appreciate, Royce, the chance to come talk to the chamber and welcome, obviously, you when you come to Washington, D.C. Sandy and I are always glad to see you, and particularly in Washington, where, as Harry Reid said, if you need a friend, not Harry Reid, Harry Truman. I misspoke. Harry Truman said, if you need a friend in Washington, get a dog. So that's why I'm particularly glad to see you up there, but it's even more enjoyable for us to come back home and be with you here. So thank you for having me, and I'm glad to answer or dodge a few questions, as the case may be.
I have about an hour and a half worth of questions here, and it's been whispered in my ear we have 5 minutes to do them in. So first the question from your staff, they said I could ask any question as long as it was true, false, and was asking about your favorite color. It is maroon, right? That's what I thought. It was good to hear you talking about lifting the regulatory burden. But I know that Louisiana is still out right now, mm-hmm. but we're looking at quite possibly a 52-48 Senate, and that's not 60. So how would you propose that get pushed through the Senate, these rules that we need to lift?
Well, I talked to John Kennedy, who's the Republican nominee in Louisiana this morning, and that's a runoff that'll occur in December, and I'm pretty confident that he'll get elected. So you're right, it'll be 52. It's not 60. And you know, in the Senate, that's kind of a magic number because of our unique cloture requirements. But the good news is that there's a number of things that we can do, like repeal Obamacare, and that only takes 51 votes. I didn't mention it, but we actually did that this last year. It was vetoed by President Obama, as we knew it would be. But what it demonstrated is that if, in fact, we had a new president, that Congress was able to do it, and we would actually be able to accomplish that. Then the challenging process of coming together on an alternative is going to be nigh upon us. There are other things we can do called the Congressional Review Act that only require 51 votes in the Senate to repeal some of these regulations, and I think you're going to see a real flurry of activity early on in that front. Supreme Court nominations. We got a vacancy now with Justice Scalia's vacancy. The Democrats said if they were in charge, they would change the Senate rules to make that a 51-vote threshold, and I think that's likely that we will do that as well. As a practical matter, that's really been the rule anyway as a de facto matter. So I think there's a lot we can do. Here's the challenge. I know there's some who would like to say, well, the Senate should change its rules and not require a threshold of 60 votes in order to close off debate to pass something with 51 votes, but the whole design of our founding fathers is to create a structure that would build consensus. And so I think it's really a mistake, I think Obamacare is a good example of that, of trying to do things on strictly a partisan basis. They don't have any staying power because the rest of the country and the other party isn't invested in its success. And frankly, I think it's too easy to make mistakes if you just do things on a strictly partisan basis. So we're going to do a little bit of both, but I'm pretty confident we're going to make some real progress.
Some of the people that I've talked to made their decision about which lever they're going to pull mm-hmm. based on the Supreme Court. Right. And if nothing else, it gave you a clear conscience. Are there anybody on President-elect Trump's list that he released before the election that you like?
I think there are about 20 people that his names he floated. He's been consulting with the Federalist Society, which is a conservative legal society in Washington, about some proposed nominees. There's a lot of good people who served in the federal judiciary who I think would make great appointees. I know one of them is Justice Willett here in Texas, whose name was on there. You know, frankly, we've got some other Texans who would be good. Ted Cruz would be, I think, a great appointment if he would be interested. I don't know whether he is. So I think there's going to be no shortage of good people. Again, people who believe in the rule of law and believe that you ought to apply the Constitution and laws as written, not substitute your own policy judgments for those of the elected representatives of the people or the written Constitution as written. So there's going to be a lot to choose from.
Who would you like to see leading the Justice Department? What changes would you like to see made there, perhaps?
Well, to me, that's been one of the most disturbing developments of the current administration, because I'm old-fashioned. I believe that the job of the Attorney General and the Justice Department is to is to administer equal justice under the law. And that means sometimes you got to tell your friends or the people in your own political party that they've overstepped and done the wrong thing. But what we've seen is a pattern of giving a pass, abuse, and outright corruption, I would say, in refusing to treat everybody the same under the law. So to me, that's the single most important thing. The next Attorney General, the next Department of Justice, is going to have to help regain the public's confidence in the rule of law, in our ability to administer justice fairly and equally in the country, rather than just be another political arm of the White House.
Your staff is starting to gather. I appreciate very much your answering these questions, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.